don't know what you think, but I reckon that's how to sing a high D. The UK debut here at the Proms of Venera Gimagieva. I suspect she'll be back here in the UK pretty soon singing again. Russian soprano, part of the ensemble at the Bolshoi Theatre in Moscow, making her Proms and UK debut here with the John Wilson Orchestra. Where to close part one, we have music next by Eric Korngold.
We'll be right back.
Eric Korngold's Sweet Robin Hood from the 1938 Warner Bros. Movie. Closing the first half of tonight's prom from the John Wilson Orchestra, led tonight by Andrew Havron. A prom that John Wilson's called his Hollywood Rhapsody, a celebration of some of this great orchestral music produced in the 20th century for a mass audience, and constructed with such incredible panache and craftsmanship by this army of composers, many of them émigrés fleeing from Nazi Europe. And of course, Europe's loss was Hollywood's gain. Musicians like Korngold, Waxman, Steiner, bringing that lush European style, their sumptuous gift to a melody, and turning those into the Hollywood sound. All that music played with such evident love as well by the players of the John Wilson Orchestra tonight. I was talking to one of the cellists earlier today who said there isn't a musician in the UK who wouldn't want to be part of this band. There's so few opportunities to play this kind of repertoire, and you could see in rehearsals they just love doing it. Well, worth saying that things are, of course, whizzing along, zipping along at a great pace here. If you want full programme notes or any more information on any of the music in tonight's concert, just go to our website, bbc.co.uk/proms, and you'll find a whole load of info there. It's interval time now, around 20 minutes or so, and in a little while, I'll be talking to tonight's conductor, John Wilson. First, though, time for one of our Proms Plus extravaganzas, recorded earlier today across the road at the Royal College of Music and presented by film buff Matthew Sweet.
Hello and welcome to the intermission in tonight's film music prom. The audience here in the cheap seats at the Royal College of Music are enjoying their Newbury fruits and their Kiora. I'll have a drink on a stick, please, Dolly. And I have to tell you that just before the lights went down, the commissionaire discovered two lauded experts on big screen music trying to sneak into the one and nines. So we've come to an arrangement with them. We're going to let them stay in exchange for some empty jam jars and the benefit of their knowledge tonight. They are Debbie Wiseman, the screen composer whose crotchets have counterpointed the action of Wilde, Father Brown, and Lesbian Vampire Killers. Yes, that is three different productions. And David Benedict, who, to use the slang of his own organ, Variety, is one of the top cricks of Cleffers and Hoofers. In short, if he's mitting, it must be Hotsy. Would you welcome them, please? Now, some people, it has to be said, are a little sniffy about film music, aren't they? They say, how can this be art when it's enslaved to these images? But I want to start our conversation tonight by seeing what you make of a big claim, really, that movie music is where classical orchestral music has gone. The inheritors of the 19th century orchestral tradition, they're in Hollywood, David.
I think that's true. You know, people like to say, oh, classical music's dead, which obviously to a proms audience is not the case. But lots of newspaper editors and lots of other pundits seem to think that orchestral music is this minority interest. And then you look at the album sales of the soundtrack of Lord of the Rings, the Howard Shaw score, has sold hundreds of thousands of copies. And huge orchestral scores are being written, and people are listening to them. There's, of course, the audience that goes to the cinema or watches movies on DVD who are hearing the music and not actually listening to it, because the music is written in service of the image. But actually, there is more and more a whole kind of style of programming in concert halls where film scores are being programmed. That's been happening for a long time now, and it's very popular.
Debbie?
I think it's interesting with this particular concert that we think of the lush, big Hollywood sound as if it had almost always existed. But actually, these composers, Korngold and Waxman, they went over to Hollywood, and they had been writing very successfully in the concert hall, you know, this great, lush, romantic music that they had written. They then took that to Hollywood, and so these émigré composers went over there, took their music, and created this great Hollywood sound that we now know and love, with these sweeping strings and the great, gorgeous melodies that they composed. And, of course, Strauss had a great influence and Wagner and Mahler as well, on these composers. You can hear it in their music.
So is this how we should think of the genealogy of this music? We should speak of Korngold and Steiner as we speak of Mahler and of Wagner, say?
I think that's difficult. I think that particularly Hermann, who wasn't an emigre composer, was born in America, but people like Waxman and Miklos Roscher, they had parallel careers. They were very aware that whilst their music is of an extremely high quality, it is in service to something else. So there were lots of arguments about whether this music was truly symphonic. Korngold referred to some of his music as being symphonic, but lots of composers in Hollywood argued that it wasn't because it wasn't music on its own terms.
But then again, Hermann, he didn't actually... there was no dumbing down of his music for the screen. He wrote exactly the same for the concert hall as he did for the screen. And you can hear, because, you know, Schoenberg and Stravinsky were out there in Los Angeles at the same time, you can hear their influence in his music very clearly. And I don't think he thought any differently about the music that he wrote for the concert hall.
I suppose the association between the film and orchestral music predates that moment when recorded music begins on film, doesn't it? Because silent audiences for silent films would have gone into the cinemas, and if they were in a posh cinema, they would have seen a big orchestra playing that music live and possibly scored too, or even using musical cues from that 19th century tradition.
Yeah, and I mean, the point at which sound arrives, and we could get into a lot of technical details, but let's, for the sake of argument, say 1927 with The Jazz Singer, Warner Brothers film, which has dialogue sort of relaxed as if overheard dialogue, as opposed to anything formal which had preceded it, that is surrounded by music. And initially, scores were rather small. The original scores, the producers of those films were worried that music might drown out the dialogue because the technology was pretty basic in those days. So in the early 30s, music tended to be at the beginning and the end. It's only really from the mid-30s onwards that the scores get very big and very lush. So you end up with really, really giant scores like Gone with the Wind, which has an enormous amount.
Yes, it was sort of over 3 hours of music.
3 hours of music.
And the amazing
exactly.
thing was that Steiner wrote that in, I think it was about 12 weeks,
yeah.
while he was writing other movie scores. So he wasn't just doing that. So the extraordinary prolific nature of these composers was I mean, just the volume that they wrote. And also Warner Brothers at the time was maybe producing something like 50 movies a year. So they might have been, writing to two or three pictures at a time.
Well, let's hear some of that music, Steiner's music from Gone with the Wind, and see if we can deconstruct it a bit. Of film composition, but it's so hard to know what's in the music and how much it functions as sort of trigger for the memories, my memories of the film. I mean, what is this doing? What job is it doing, this music? It's got loads of strings, and we heard the bells too, I think, from the ident of
the Selznick
company. Is this musical technicolor?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I think it is important to recognise quite how much labour goes into fashioning these things. That score was written, as Debbie says, in 12 weeks. He had five orchestrators working on it. He wrote 3 hours of music. 2.5 hours of it were used. There are 99 separate cues. Steiner said that if Wagner were alive today, this was in the 30s, if Wagner were alive today, he'd be the number one movie composer. I think that's a debatable point, but but I think what he was getting at...
His score for Apocalypse Now was great.
Oh, no, fantastic. Shame it wasn't used. But no, the point being is that Steiner uses Wagner leitmotifs all the time. He absolutely... kind of really pushes the idea of themes attached to particular characters and particular situations. So you've got that main theme there, which is then used to do enormous dramatic and storytelling work by being played at key moments in order to elicit a response. Mm.
Put us in the mind of the composer, Debbie, when you're working on a film score, what are the organising principles?
Well, you try and find a hook, a leitmotif, something that's going to work for the film that feels absolutely seamless, so that when the two come together, they could never be apart. So when we think about Jaws, we think about the shark theme. When we think about Gone with the Wind, we think about Tara's theme. There's something there that is absolutely unique to that picture. It's very hard to do, you know, coming up with a simple tune that works. I mean, Bernard Herrmann would always orchestrate his own music, and his music was more experimental than Korngold, and it didn't have that romanticism. But he would always want to orchestrate, and so would come up with very unusual lineups, and sometimes maybe use 12 flutes or odd mixtures of instruments. But he would always want to be in complete control of every single note that he wrote, and he would say that having an orchestrator would be like somebody else putting colour to your paintings. He wanted to colour every single note of the music. And I think that's very key to his particular sound.
Well, I mean, there was so much Herrmann that we wanted to include in the concert, but you just can't do it for a whole number of reasons, not least economic. I mean, there's a marvellous score he wrote, Beneath the 12-Mile Reef, which is scored for 9 harps with no doubling. And the cost of hiring an extra 7 harpists is slightly prohibitive. But then there are other scores. Journey to the Center of the Earth has everything except strings. Psycho has only strings. I mean, his orchestration and his tonal palette is so unique and so interesting.
Well, let's hear Bernard Herrmann's most famous composition. This is Music to Get Murdered By. Bernard Herrmann, you know, shower scene music from Hitchcock's Psycho, I needed to say that.
No, Debbie. But it's interesting that Hitchcock didn't want music for the shower scene originally, and Herrmann had to persuade him, and afterwards he's known to have said to Herrmann that had the suggestion, it was an improper suggestion, not to have music over that scene. And of course now it so completely sums it up. And what his music does is make the visuals seem much more brutal, much more gruesome than they would be if that music wasn't there. None of us really, unless we're composers working on a film, ever see a film without music. So it's hard to explain what it brings to a picture and the power of music over the image. But when you see a film without music on, and you might just see Janet Leigh driving along in the car, and then you see that same scene but with Bernard Herrmann's disturbing underscore, it completely changes our perception of that scene.
Interesting thing to me is that when we think of the shower scene, we think we watch Janet Leigh being stabbed, except we don't. We never see the knife enter her flesh or a dummy of her flesh. We don't see it, but the music, there's a visual gap which the music fills, so that the entire image with sound makes you see the stabbing that actually isn't there.
Is the reason why this works so well because we're, in a way, we're being attacked on three fronts here. We see the movement of that knife, even if, as David says, we never see it entering Janet Leigh. There's the stabbing action of those violin bows, and then the kind of the razor work of the editing too. Somehow these three things are all working
together.
Of course,
yes, they all have to come together, and it is a masterstroke of filmmaking. The thing about music in film is that it goes straight to the heart of your emotions and you believe the music. Whatever you're seeing visually, you believe what the music's telling you. So if the music is telling us fear and terror, That's what we believe as the audience.
You've scored plenty of slaughter in your career, haven't you, Debbie? How do you, you know, what tunes go with murders best? How does it work?
Well, sometimes, actually, silence can be quite good for a murder, or at least for the revealing of a murder. I'm working on Father Brown at the moment, where there's a murder every episode. And sometimes the music leads up to it, and the shock of the actual body is left without music. It depends on the particular scene, but music is a wonderful way of helping the audience experience whatever emotion it is that you want them to experience.
But did Hollywood studios in the 30s and 40s, David, have a kind of house style? Is it possible to, you know, to recognise a particular studio's sound as opposed to the work of a particular composer?
I think you probably can't identify a house style in terms of its music. You can identify studios in terms of the type of films they were doing. So Warner Brothers is sort of the home of a lot of gritty stuff, a lot of film noir. MGM, obviously, in the 40s is home of the Freed unit and the opulent musicals. But you know, there are 300 musicals made between sort of the 1940s, well, about 1940 to 1950. But I can't stress enough the production line nature of this. There were 7,000 films released between 1930 and 1945. There are 8 major studios, five majors, 3 minors, who are producing all those films. That works out at more than 1 a week. And from each of the studios, there's an absolute production line. Max Steiner, between 1947 and 1948, wrote 22 film scores. You know, there is so much happening that the idea of there sort of being a defined house style is sort of impossible.
Let's home in now on the experimental side of film music. And we'll do this with a rather unusual source. Some of you might recognise what this is. Carl Stalling's music for Bugs Bunny. It does seem that music for animation was a place in which high experiment was possible.
I think there's something about animation being a fantasy and not a serious drama that allows a composer to be more experimental. And Scott Bradley did use the Schoenberg 12-note system, which takes a sort of row of notes and you can use them in any order, jumble them up, and it makes it sound much more atonal and modernist. And he took this on board and wrote the most incredibly modern music for a little mouse running around, you know. And this would be extraordinary.
But there's a sort of modernist violence audible in that too. It's something to do with the ferocity of the images as well.
There's a freedom, isn't there, as well? There's a freedom in the writing. Again, you know, Schoenberg and Stravinsky were around at the time. They were obviously influencing these composers. But you could do it in cartoons. But I know that Scott Bradley has been known to say and apologise to Schoenberg for using his 12-tone system in his music for funny music. Sorry for writing, you know, what is a very serious compositional technique. Sorry for using this for writing funny music. And I think even the people in the orchestra found it funny. You know, it was a brilliant way of using modern music in a characterful.
I think there's an interesting point in that the kind of the first major film score that really makes people sit up and, in fact, kind of sets out the stall for how music was written for at least 10 or 20 years was in 1933, Max Steiner's score for King Kong. And interestingly in that, picking up on your point, that because the producers wanted to induce a sense of horror, they were worried that a giant ape might induce laughter in audiences. So Steiner was allowed to write music that was much more atonal and much more, quotes, difficult than he was otherwise allowed to write when writing his say, 18 film scores that he wrote for Bette Davis. Mm.
So we've talked about Waxman and Steiner and Korngold. Of the film composers practicing today, you know, present company accepted, Debbie, of course, who are the names that you would add to that list?
Well, I think their tradition has followed through. My favourite composer, of the more modern times, is John Barry, who takes up those sweeping, gorgeously, achingly beautiful melodies. John Williams, of course, Elmer Bernstein, Morricone, all these composers are brilliant at writing melody and memorable tunes that will stay with us for you know, far longer than possibly the films that they wrote for.
I think one of my... It always surprises me when I think about this, but I'm not... I know this is sacrilege, but I'm not a huge John Williams fan. I admire him no end, but I find a lot of the scores bear too much similarity to themselves. However, I think my favourite recent film score of recent years is Catch Me If You Can, which is the most brilliant pastiche of 50s movies. There's sort of 50s into the early 60s. There's finger clicking, which sounds like it's come out of West Side Story, which of course the stage version is 58, the movie is 61. It just has this extraordinary atmosphere. It uses marimba, it's very percussive, it's utterly distinctive and extraordinarily atmospheric.
Mm. And that's it, because the title sequence of that film as well is like a pastiche of a Saul Bass title
yes.
sequence, you know, and the kind of the leading figure in the creation of such things from that moment. So the two things go fantastically well together, don't they?
It's very smart. It's kind of, I just think the way that score works with that sequence and the entire movie is it's a really beautiful piece of work.
That's all, folks. It's time now for us to go back to the main feature. But before the lights go down, you've time to give a 5-star review to our guests, David Benedict and Debbie Wiseman.
That was Matthew Sweet. Well, a very warm welcome back to tonight's live prom from me, Susie Klein. We are backstage here at the Royal Albert Hall, and I'm delighted to be joined by tonight's conductor, John Wilson. Hello, congratulations on a first half.
Thank you.
You seem to be enjoying yourself, young man. You were smiling a lot.
And that was the scariest half, so I might even smile even more in the second half.
You are here, bat on your hand, so we do know you're going to be going on in the second half. You're not leaving the building.
Very soon, definitely.
Music in this half by Jerome Ross, Max Steiner, who was, you know, this amazing World War I emigre. How did you then put together... I mean, you have so much music to choose from, John, when it's Hollywood orchestral stalls. How did you go about fixing the programme?
First thing was to choose all the important composers, the sort of pioneers who created the sound of the golden age of Hollywood, and then to choose movies that people were familiar with, and some that they might know but would have had terrific scores, and then most importantly pieces which would stand up on their own in concert, so concert pieces.
But that sounds rather like a crossword or a jigsaw puzzle. Was it one of those things where it all fell into place, or how long does it take?
Endless. I mean, half a year, and like reshuffling all the time the order in which things go in the programme, and it is, as I've said before, like a three-dimensional game of chess. One alteration to the programme and the whole lot can fall apart.
How many drafts are we talking about?
Nearly 50.
Really?
Yeah.
50?
Yeah, that many, literally.
Okay, but now you're doing it and it's happening for real. You're happy with the way you did your concert?
I think I've got it right.
We'll find out in the second half. One of the highlights for me in rehearsals this morning was this Scott Bradley music, Tom and Jerry. Amazingly atmospheric. Everybody knows it, but is it easy to play?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I just know it's fast and it's furious, but does that make it fun and easy, or does that make
it
really challenging?
It makes it fast and furious and bloody hard.
That's a technical term.
Yeah.
And we've got pistols going off and plates being shattered and...
The whole works, yeah.
How are you going to rein them all in? Because I can see how much fun they're having out there.
Oh, no, it's under control. It was in rehearsals, anyway. Goodness knows what they get up to.
The iron fist of John Wilson.
Ooh!
Do you find when you're in the middle of doing something like this, John, is there a bit of your brain that allows yourself to sort of float above it all and think, actually, this is fantastic, this is why I do this job, or is there too much concentration?
I try and enjoy it when we get to the concert. I'm pretty... My brain's engaged in rehearsals in a different way to the way it will be now.
We'll allow you to be engaged because Tammy, our concert manager, is whisking John off. Toy, have a fantastic second half. John Wilson making his way back to the stage. He's just in the bull run here of the Royal Albert Hall in the last few moments as the John Wilson Orchestra tunes. Final few adjustments of John's bow tie, a little dab of powder, the baton being handed to him. And we start the second half of tonight's prom. Music by Jerome Ross, his score for The Big Country, a 1958 Western, starring Gregory Peck, Gene Simmons and Charlton Heston. John Wilson joining the players of his orchestra for tonight's live prom here at the Royal Albert Hall. Thank you. music by the first major composer, emigre composer, to arrive in Hollywood, Max Steiner, the writer of more than 300 film scores for Hollywood. That was his Casablanca suite, performed by the John Wilson Orchestra. Next, in the celebration.
Is a wondrous thing that we'll rejoice in remembering. Our love was born with our first embrace, and a page was torn out of time. Our love affair, may it always be a flame to burn through eternity. So take my hand with a fervent prayer that we
as sure as you live. Something's gotta give, something's gotta give, something's gotta give. When an irrepressible smile such as yours warms an old implacable heart such as mine, don't say no because I insist. Somewhere, somehow, someone's gotta be kissed. So on guard, who knows what the fates might have in store from their vast mysterious sky. I'll try hard, ignoring those lips that I adore, but how hard can anyone try? Fight, 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 fight it with all of a might. Chances are some heavenly star-spangled night. We'll find out just as sure as we live.
Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all.